From listener-supported KTOO, welcome to Juno Afternoon, broadcasting from the homelands of the Occoquan and on demand as a podcast. It's Thursday, December 21st, 2023. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Gunath Sheesh, Hawa Salamat for joining the conversation. On today's show, it's the 2023 News and Review Roundup. We'll talk with the KTOO news team and highlight some of the work they covered this year, including the Mendenhall River flood, the Telephone Hill housing issues, and other stories from the capital city. Those conversations, music, and more coming up this hour on Juno Afternoon.
Support from Hanson Gress. Seeking curious people who like technology, network engineering, and customer support. Opportunities for those who thrive on problem solving. Details at hansengress.com/careers.
Listening to community-supported Juno Afternoon on KTOO at 104.3 Juno, 91.7 Juno Auk Bay, and online at ktoo.org. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. This is the KTOO News Roundup Review for 2023. This year in Southeast Alaska, there were some major weather disasters that affected folks in a variety of ways. I'm joined now by KTO reporter Anna Canny, who covers climate, weather, and more for KTOO. Gunath Sheesh Hat Yugudi. Thank you for being here today, Anna.
Thanks for having me, Boston.
Of course. So let's say first that you started at KTOO about a year ago. Is that right?
Yeah, I started. My 1 year anniversary was like 2 weeks ago.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Awesome. Well, congratulations on that. Will you share a little bit about where you're from and your background before arriving in Juneau?
Yeah, I grew up in upstate New York. And so I was living in New York and went to school in New York, lived in New York City before I moved here. So that's where I spent most of my life. And my background before this was obviously had done environmental things. I was, as long as I can remember, I wanted to study environmental science and, I was really interested in the natural world. So I did study environmental science in my undergrad, but didn't really know what I wanted to do. I bounced around between a bunch of things, studied like water resource management and flooding, then ecology, and then coastal resilience, and just bounced around a lot, like I said. And so the journalism piece came later for me after I graduated, where I was like, well, I don't, when you go to grad school or something like that, which is what I assumed I would do, you have to pick a focus. And I just never could. I was interested in too many different types of science. And so, yeah, that's how I found journalism. I figured I could write about anything. And so started making the transition to that and spent a year in podcast production, working on a podcast about environmental disaster hurricane recovery in Louisiana, and finished up that project right before I came here. So
wow, that's so cool. And how did you first, what was the first inclination of sort of like climate or weather issues? Where did that seed come from? Was it when you were younger, like in high school or earlier?
Well, even earlier, I think. I was actually just telling this story to a friend the other day. We had this thing in fourth grade where we had to dress up as a historical figure. And I picked Rachel Carson. I wrote an essay about her and Silent Spring and had to dress up as her and pose as her. And I mean, she was an environmental journalist. I don't think I thought that much about it at the time, but I love to spend a lot of time outdoors. I was a real nature kid. And so I think that's where it started. But
that's so cool. Well, yeah. It's been so great to have you here. And this year has been pretty full.
Yeah. Yep.
Let's take a listen to the major story that you did on the event here in Juneau, the Mendenhall River flood caused by the Suicide Basin glacial outburst.
Hydrologist Aaron Hood is shuffling across patches of vivid blue ice. He and two other scientists follow a silty channel that runs between a steep mountain slope and the edge of Mendenhall Glacier.
So this last week would have all, we would have been all underwater here.
They're headed to a glacial basin known as Suicide Basin. It sits about 2 miles above the glacier's terminus. Just a few days ago, 13 billion gallons of water drained out of that basin and carved through here. Then it spilled down to Mendenhall Lake and out into Mendenhall River, which rose 9 feet in a matter of hours. It was the worst glacial outburst flood in Juneau's history. The team moved towards the mouth of the channel, weaving through small streams of water and dripping house-sized blocks of ice that were left behind by the flood. After a steep ascent over loose boulders, they're standing at the lip of Suicide Basin. It's a deep, bowl-shaped valley, dwarfed by peaks surrounding it. On one end, the vast expanse of the Mendenhall Glacier. The glacier here acts as a dam, trapping rain and meltwater in the valley. Before the flood, it was filled to the brim. Now, it's empty. That's because when the water builds up enough pressure, it cracks through the ice. Then it works its way through those cracks, out under the glacier, and downstream to the Mendenhall River, triggering the flood. That same process has happened every year since 2011. But Hood has been studying the glacier at the University of Alaska Southeast for more than 2 decades, and he remembers a time before that.
When I moved here, there was no waterfall because it was all ice, but the entire basin was filled with the glacier, so there was no room for the water to fill up.
But the glacier is receding rapidly, in part due to human-caused climate change. So that's what revealed the basin in the first place. And as the glacier keeps melting, it continues to change the size and shape of the basin. Understanding how it's changing can help scientists better predict future floods. At the basin's edge, Hood lays out a miniature helipad and a small drone. The drone flies back and forth across the basin over the course of a few hours. It takes thousands of aerial photos to capture every crack and crevice. Even when it's empty, the basin is filled with huge chunks of ice that were left behind by glacial retreat.
So that's a big concern, is that the more all of this ice sitting in here can melt, the bigger the flood's going to be.
And scientists believe that the ice is melting faster than ever. At the same time, as the glacier melts, it's pulling back from the edge of the basin, making it wider. That means there's both more meltwater and more space to store that water. So there's the potential for larger floods. But that's only one factor that determines how bad a flood will be. Hydrologist Ed Neal of Alaska Hydroscience says the trickier part is understanding how fast the water drains from the basin.
You know, you got X amount of water. If you let it out a garden hose, it's going to take a long time to drain it. If you let it out a fire hose, it's going to take a short time to drain it.
This year, it was more like a fire hose. The water drained fast, causing a higher flood peak and more damaging flow. But the drainage channels where water comes out are buried in tons of ice. They're basically impossible to get to. This leaves scientists with an unsolvable equation. With the drone survey, they can only find one variable, which means predicting Juneau's glacial outburst floods will remain a bit of a crapshoot. What they can say for sure is that another major glacial outburst flood will come. Hood says that the threat of flooding will remain until the Mendenhall Glacier melts away to a point where it can no longer dam the basin.
This flood will probably occur for decades. It's unlikely that we would have experienced the largest flood within the first 10 years or so.
Meanwhile, extreme rainfall is becoming more frequent across Southeast Alaska. If the next big glacial outburst flood coincides with a drenching rainstorm, the damage could be even worse. So the residents who live along the bank of Mendenhall River shouldn't expect a major flood every year, but they should expect something worse in the coming decades, because high above Juneau, the basin keeps growing. In Juneau, I'm Anna Canny.
Wow. That was a major event. I mean, I know most of us saw sort of the posts, the videos of, you know, different buildings falling into the river and, but this is up at the source. And so that was really interesting sort of science and technology around like how it's happening and maybe, you know, what we need to expect for the future. But have we learned anything else since the flood happened or that story that you did?
Yeah, they're still trying to figure a lot of things out. They're trying to beef up and upgrade some of the monitoring tech that's up there. They did analyze that data that they collected with the drone and figure out some more precision about the shape of the basin and the ways that it's growing and changing. And so they can use that, the Weather Service and hydrologists at UAS can use that to create better models about when the flood peak will happen, when it happens next, because they feed that into the models they use to tell us, yeah, what the flood's going to look like each year. And but, you know, it changes every year. It's ice, obviously, as I explained in the story. So, you know, we're going to have to be doing those types of surveys like was featured in that story pretty frequently to understand how the flood might come down differently from year to year. And as I mentioned at the end of the story there, there's a potential for these floods to get worse, but on the year-to-year variations, we just don't know. It could be much smaller next year. It could be.
Is there a place that people can go, or things that people should be thinking about, individuals who might be living, you know, near the river line, or what can people do to prepare, I guess?
Yeah, the National Weather Service and the Alaska Climate Adaptation Center both have a page that has, you can watch a live feed, basically. It's like a time-lapse photo of the basin as it fills and drains each year. Right now, it's probably pretty low, or it's not at its peak that it reaches in the summertime. And so you can watch it there. And they have some graphs and models about like how it's filling and the rate at which it's filling there. So there's some websites for that. And I don't have specifics about this yet, but I'm sure that next year there's going to be they issue flood watch and flood warning every year when this happens. In fact, like before the big one this year, I had like written a whole story about how it's going to be this peak. And obviously it turned out to be much bigger. But with this more precise data on the basin, next year's flood warning from the Weather Service should be much more accurate. So that's the hope.
Okay. Now, the other major event that you covered was the Wrangell landslide. Let's listen to this story.
On the evening of November 20th, the rain that had been soaking Wrangell for days grew even stronger. Angie Flickinger was in her house on Zamovia Highway that night, listening to it pound on the roof.
All of a sudden, I heard this like very loud sound, like it had been amplified tenfold. It almost sounded like a jet.
A half mile up the road, Flickinger's friend Jamie Roberts heard it too. She opened her door to look for a plane, and the sound got even louder.
And it got so loud that I think I yelled to my husband, and I was like, something is wrong with the jet. It's coming down, and it's coming down like on our house.
Just a few hundred feet away, Roberts' neighbor, Christina Florschutz, knew exactly what the sound was. She'd heard mudslides before.
I didn't have any warning. I heard a noise, and suddenly I'm like a piece of weightless popcorn being tossed around all over the place and slamming into things. And then I don't remember anymore for a while.
That night, a burst of heavy rain drenched the already sodden hillside around mile 11 of Zamovia Highway. And just before 9 p.m., the earth gave way. A flow of mud roared down the hillside and buried the homes of the Florschutz family and the Heller family who lived across the road. The Hellers and their two daughters were later found dead, along with Christina's husband, Otto Florschutz. It was the deadliest landslide in recent Alaska history. From the beach that night, Roberts could see the silhouette of a big pile of debris just up the coast, and she could smell it.
Like Christmas wreaths, you know. So it was a very overwhelming conifer smell.
She'd fled to the beach with her husband and son just as the slide came down. The family was badly shaken. The heavy rain was soaking through their clothes, but they were afraid to move.
There were some loud cracking noises on the hillside. So we figured if we just stand in this one spot and are quiet, we'll be able to know which way are we going if more starts coming down the hill.
Back on the road, almost everyone else had no idea what had happened. Flickinger lives about a half mile away from where the slide came down. She thought maybe a small slide had come down somewhere near her property. That had happened before. But with her headlamp, she couldn't see much of anything.
The power went out, and I went outside. The creeks were just raging, and it was so noisy outside. But never in a million years thought it would be what it was.
The slide had taken down landlines and internet, along with the electricity. And that far out of town, the cell reception is spotty. Flickinger couldn't get through to anyone who could tell her what had happened, so she started to get ready for bed.
Just as I was doing that, my phone rang, and I picked it up, and it was a friend in town, and she told me that there had been a big slide, like a major slide.
But even as word of the slide traveled around, there was still mass confusion in the first few hours. people didn't know where to go. Some went towards the slide with flashlights and hand shovels. Others fled in the opposite direction, searching for a flat place to camp out. And some stayed in their houses, waiting in silence and preparing to make a quick escape. Search and rescue teams eventually arrived to evacuate people, but it still took them hours to find everyone in the pitch dark. They found Flickinger and Roberts wandering around on the road. They sent everyone to a neighbor's backyard dock. A ferry was waiting there, pinned up against the dock by strong winds. Evacuees waited on board for 3 hours, bobbing in the nasty weather, waiting for more people, and piecing together the night's events through the search and rescue chatter on the radio.
We had heard that a couple neighbors had been impacted and that it likely wasn't good. I think we were all already grieving.
By the time the ferry set off for town, 19 people were on board. They got to Wrangell close to 4 a.m. And when they got cell service, Robert's phone was flooded with messages from her own friends and from the friends and family of her neighbors, the Hellers and the Florschutz.
Basically, my message was like, I have not seen them. It would be a miracle, you know, if people were able to make it out of there.
Somehow, Christina Florschutz did. She woke up beneath a piece of roof from her destroyed house. She staved off hypothermia by wrapping herself in a bag of fleece that was nearby in the remains of her crushed sewing room. And at daybreak, she climbed out and started to make her way across the debris field.
And I see hats coming through the trees. And people! Boy, am I glad to see you! And they heard me yell, and they came and got me.
Florschutz says she'll look for a new home in Wrangell, somewhere on flat land. Roberts will be looking for a new place, too. Her house isn't damaged, but she can hardly stand to be inside for more than a few minutes.
But I just keep being like, I'm alive and I have my family.
The rest, she says, they can figure out later. With help from Colette Zarnicki and Caroline James, I'm Anna Canny in Wrangell.
So that was the Wrangell mudslide. Not the happiest of stories, unfortunately.
No.
A lot of devastation there. And you were on the scene there. Can you share a little bit about what that experience was like?
Yeah, I mean, it was unlike anything I've reported on before. Unlike anything I've ever seen before, I don't come from a place with landslides. I've obviously been aware of the possibility of landslides ever since I moved here to Southeast, but to see it with my own eyes was just pretty gut-wrenching. We saw it from a boat, and it's just bigger than I can even, I think, properly describe. But being on the scene was both, I think, really beautiful in a lot of ways. Wrangell really banded together and supported each other, and just so many people were helping out. It was constant activity there, neighbors helping neighbors, really sort of an impromptu emergency management response, you know. But of course, it was also devastating to see in a small town like that, Wrangell's just about 2,000 people, how connected those folks that were, you know, lost in the landslide were to the community. You talk to any person I talked to in that story could name 5 different connections they had with those families, some who were affected. And so, yeah, it was really hard. And it was, you know, to empathize with the people that I talked to in that story who are now making this choice of, like, you know, across Southeast, we have a problem of housing in hazardous areas and a housing shortage in many communities, including Wrangell. And they're now facing a decision about, like, how do we, you know, make informed choices about our public safety? And it's just with something so unpredictable and potentially massive as landslides, which are so relatively understudied in this region and everywhere, it's really hard to make those decisions. And so, I mean, from a science perspective, that's, you know, a really important frontier that we're at in Southeast.
It always amazes me how resilient communities are when there's a disaster like this. And it just speaks to the volumes of Wrangell. And I hope that they, you know, look forward to the future and figuring out safer and better ways to handle their housing situation in the future.
Yeah. Yeah. It was really incredible to see.
Okay. So is there anything coming up reporting wise that we should be on the lookout for in the new year?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there's with climate and weather reporting, there are so many things I want to do. That's one of my favorite things about it, is it touches on every aspect of life. So I got a lot of ideas. certainly more reporting on landslides. There's a lot to be done on that front. And so I will be doing a series of stories on that, most likely. Other things I want to look out for, more sort of weather explainer stories. I have a lot of fun with that. We have really complicated and weird weather that makes weather forecasting really hard here in Southeast. So love to dig into that more and spend some time with meteorologists kind of breaking that down for you. And I'd also love to report on just more climate planning, climate adaptation planning across the region, things that people are doing to cut carbon emissions, you know, upgrade electrification and basically start working towards preparing for a future under climate change. I think those types of stories are really important. So hoping to dig into more of those too.
And finally, can you share like a favorite hobby or a book or a podcast that you love?
Sure. Yeah. One thing I've been thinking about a lot, I've had a really busy 6 months, two natural disasters. And so I'm taking off some time at the end of this month, and I am an avid crocheter. So I have big plans to make a sweater when I have my time off. So I guess that's one hobby that I do a lot of.
I love it. That's great. Well, Anna Gunath-Cheesh, for this work that you do in the ever-changing world, the climate-changing world, having somebody able to focus on these kinds of stories is so informative and vital for the community. So thanks for coming in and sharing about that today.
Yeah, I'm really happy to do it. Thank you.
Gunath-Cheesh. You're listening to KTOO's News in Review on Juno Afternoon from KTOO. KTOO would like to acknowledge that we broadcast from the homelands of the Akwan. The Glenadi have stewarded this area for thousands of years. Today, our studios sit on a spot once part of the tidelands, now covered over with buildings, roads, and parking lots. We recognize those families who traveled to and from these tidelands to fishing and hunting grounds and to gatherings in other villages, and still cherish it as an important part of their way of life for today and for future generations. This is Juno Afternoon from your listener-supported public media station, KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. This is our KTOO News Roundup Review for 2023. I'm joined now in Studio 2K by KTOO reporter Katie Anastas, who covered a wide range of things having to do with our fair city of Juno. Gunath-Cheesh, hat-yi gudi. Hi, Katie.
Hi.
It's so good to have you in the studio.
Thanks for having me.
So, like Anna, you have also been here for just about a year now. Congratulations on that. Will you share just a little bit about where you're from and your background before arriving to the fair city of Juno?
Sure. I'm from San Diego, California. I went to grad school a couple years ago because I knew I wanted to be a radio reporter. And after that, I got an internship at KFSK in Petersburg, and I was a nervous wreck to go all the way across the country and go from New York City to Petersburg. But it was a big change, but it was, you know, the best kind of possible life change that I could ask for at that point. Fell in love with Petersburg, fell in love with Alaska, and I knew I wanted to stay. So after that, I went up to Anchorage for a bit, covered education up there, and then a job opened up here at KTOO, and I knew I wanted to get back down to home in Southeast, so here I am.
Awesome. Well, we are the better for it. Thank you so much for choosing us. And so what are your interests when it comes to news? And also, I'm really curious, like, why public media?
Some of my main interests in coverage are, I would say, housing issues. I've really loved covering tourism here in Juno in particular. I still really love education reporting, and that's something I am hoping to expand on in this upcoming year. I like covering a lot of cultural events, especially if they involve language preservation. I think that's kind of the power of radio, is getting to hear people's voices. And I think stories about language really fit well with that format. I don't know. I like to cover a little bit of everything. And thankfully, my city beat allows me to kind of dip my toe in a lot of different things.
And I know you mentioned that one of your interests is housing. And we're going to talk a little bit about that because you've been following Telephone Hill this year, a very important area in Juneau and a little bit contentious here and there. So let's listen to one of the first stories that you did on Telephone Hill.
When Tony Tangs took the stage at the Alaska Folk Festival this year, he sang an ode to his Juneau neighborhood, Telephone Hill.
It's where the oldest house you'll find. It's like you just step back in time. It's a breath of fresh air from the hectic scene. And the neighbors like it there because it's so damn rare. Keep old Telephone Hill forever to be seen.
Tangs knows that oldest house well. He's rented one half of it for 28 years. It's also the neighborhood's namesake. The Webster family ran Alaska's first commercial telephone service out of the house.
I call it the West Wing. And had some fabulous times here.
Telephone Hill has 7 houses and 1 5-unit apartment building. The state of Alaska was their landlord until March, when the city and borough of Juneau took over. This summer, there will be a series of public meetings on the future of this neighborhood. Nothing has been decided yet, but Tangs is already moving out. His floor is covered in boxes and musical instrument cases as he prepares to move into a nearby apartment community for older adults. But he thinks his neighbors shouldn't have to move until the city is ready to break ground on whatever comes next.
If we treasure what is old, maybe we've got a bit more soul. In the future, it will shine much more than gold.
The city's first step as owner was to select a new property manager, who will collect rent for the city through at least the end of September. But that's as far into the future residents can see so far. City Manager Rory Watt says these are the latest milestones in a long process.
I think for the tenants, maybe it's an increasing sense of change is really likely to happen.
Watt says the city will likely build new housing on the property. He says it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to add units in a desirable location downtown. The lack of housing and the rise of short-term rentals have made it harder for Juneau businesses to hire employees.
I think this is a classic good of the many versus good of the few type issue. I'd like to see several hundred units of housing available for the community on that property. Right now, I think we have 17 people living up there.
The city has also started negotiating with a planner and designer. Watt expects them to spend 3 to 5 months on a redevelopment plan. The city has tasked the planner with considering a no-build option, too. But Watt says that seems unlikely.
The assembly's goals, which it sets every year, is dominated by housing issues. And there's nothing wrong about preserving a historic neighborhood. It just doesn't meet what we're trying to do.
Some tenants, like Roald Simonson, plan to stay as long as they can. He's lived on Telephone Hill for 20 years, in a bright studio lined wall-to-wall with bookshelves.
Come in. We're going to see this new person here. Look at this.
Hi. Simonson has started keeping an eye out for other housing.
Yeah, you have to.
But he has a request for city leaders.
Just don't move us off here until you have to. And, don't sort of jump the gun on it. Don't say like, well, we got to get the residents off here for whatever happens. Let's do that. And then have things sit for 6 months or 8 months or a year or 3 years.
He says he hopes the city picks a redevelopment plan that makes future generations proud. Skip Gray moved to Telephone Hill in the 70s. He's holding out hope that the city will preserve the existing houses.
I loved living here. I had a great group of friends, great group of neighbors. There's a lot of history in this house.
Gray has since moved out of the neighborhood, but standing outside his former home, he remembers hosting visiting musicians and throwing New Year's Eve parties. The house sits on a lot once owned by Richard Harris, an early prospector and partner of Joe Juneau.
I would wish that people would take a good hard look at the value of history and what our kids or grandkids might be able to see remaining of that someday.
Gray says he understands the need for more housing downtown, but he doesn't think Telephone Hill should be the place to build it. He's trying to organize tenants and community members to raise awareness of the planning process and share their opinions with city leaders.
If they come with bulldozers, and tear these houses down, and I'm standing there watching, I don't want to say I didn't try.
In the meantime, he'll keep watching for updates at city assembly meetings as tenants wait to hear what's next. In Juneau, I'm Katie Anastas.
So that was the story, one of the first stories that you did on Telephone Hill. Now, a lot has taken place since then, and you've done other stories on that that you can find on kto.org. But sort of run us through like an update. What do we need to know now and what's been happening since then?
Since this story, the city has worked with a group of designers, and those designers have come up with four possible development options. They've held a couple of public meetings where people could go and offer their feedback and do some surveys at those meetings. As you mentioned before, some of that has been pretty contentious, and there, I think, has been worry on multiple sides about how much public input has actually been making it to the people who are going to make those decisions. So I'll just give a little bit of a, a little call to action here that the city has a survey out right now. It'll be out until January 9th, where they're asking people to pick which of the four development options they're most in favor of, write a little bit about what you might change or, you know, what you think could improve the ones that you like, and just kind of generally what you want to see happen in that area. Just at a city meeting, they were talking about how a lot of the feedback they've gotten so far has been from current or former tenants of the houses at Telephone Hill, and they're hoping that this survey will kind of reflect a broad group of Juneau residents and kind of what they want to see for this spot downtown.
And you can go to that survey at bit.ly/telephonehillsurvey. It's really interesting because it is a tough, it's tough, right? Because Juneau has a housing crisis. And of course, the city sees that as an opportunity to develop housing and make that happen. But then you also have its historical housing. And so it's like, what's the right call? And who knows what that is? And so definitely folks out there listening should weigh in and go to the survey, bit.ly/telephonehillsurvey. And I'm sure you'll have more on this. And you can follow the Telephone Hill stories from Katie on kto.org.
Mm-hmm. And there's going to be a lot happening with Telephone Hill coming up in January. So expect a few stories to come out of that in January.
Okay. Another huge story that you worked on this year, Katie, was the Presbyterian apology and reparations story. Let's take a listen to that, and then we can chat a little bit about that.
Dozens of kids stream into Elizabeth Paradovich Hall singing in Tlingit. Most of them wear red and black regalia dotted with mother-of-pearl buttons. One wears a Chilkat robe with yellow, black, and blue form line designs. First Alaskans Institute President and CEO Lagunai Liz Medicine Crow says it's the start of a monumental day.
While we celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day, we can also celebrate the magnitude of this moment.
Monday concluded 3 days of events meant to acknowledge the 1962 closure of Memorial Presbyterian Church, which was once located where the Juneau Fire Hall now stands. For decades, the church served a primarily Alaska Native congregation. Reverend Walter Soboloff became the church's pastor in 1940, preaching in both Tlingit and English. But in 1962, the Presbyterian Church closed Soboloff's church and loaned money to a non-Native congregation to build a new one. At the time, they cited a new policy to end segregated churches. But for Alaska Native people, Medicine Crow says, the closure meant the loss of a community hub.
These are not theoretical harms. These are real harms. These are physical, spiritual, emotional, financial harms that our community endured.
On Sunday, church leaders delivered a long-awaited apology. Reverend Bronwyn Boswell leads the U.S. denomination of the Presbyterian Church. She spoke at Kuneahiri Northern Light United Church, just a few blocks away from where Memorial Presbyterian Church once stood.
The Presbyterian Church USA apologizes for the act of spiritual abuse committed by the Presbyterian Church's decision of closure.
The apology comes after years of advocacy by a group of Alaska Native Church members. 2 years ago, the church's Native Ministries Committee came up with a list of actions and monetary contributions that could make up an apology. Some have already happened. For example, Northern Light United Church added Kuneahiri to its name, which means People's House of Healing in Tlingit. They've also committed to funding scholarship programs, incorporating Tlingit language into church services, and adding Alaska Native art and architecture to the building. Frida Westman is a member of the Native Ministries Committee.
What I'm excited about is bringing in younger people and children with the language, with the cultural practices, and seeing how those can be woven together in order to celebrate within the church setting our culture.
At Monday's event, national church leaders gave $100,000 to Sea Alaska Heritage Institute to support language revitalization efforts. The local church gave Tlingit and Haida more than $4,000 for the tribe's cultural programs. Future payments will support other educational opportunities and tribal programs. Tlingit and Haida President Chahyaish Richard Peterson says it's important to acknowledge the role churches have played in colonization and language loss throughout Alaska.
I hope that the churches really do step up and take their role in the healing as they took the role in the damage.
There's also a new sign outside the Juneau Fire Hall. It describes the closure of Sobolov's church and the Presbyterian Church's commitment to reparations. In Juneau, I'm Katie Anastas.
So that was a pretty impactful story, Katie. I know it was happening. There was an event on Indigenous Peoples Day and you covered it and you were able to publish that story in a pretty quick turnaround. But what was the experience like to attend that ceremony and be witness to these events?
It was really beautiful. I think the fact that this ceremony started with children celebrating their language and their culture, it felt like, okay, this is the next generation that will be growing up in a different environment than their parents and grandparents, where, you know, this is something that's very celebrated and, you know, there are efforts to preserve it. And I think, as President Peterson said towards the end of that story, that this is an example of a church recognizing their role in the loss of something like language and culture, and now working to repair that and preserve it.
Yeah, it's really heartwarming to see two things. One, that organizations like the churches and other organizations are beginning to take responsibility. And also that it's really heartwarming to see that language is being passed down now to the youth, and we're able to see the revitalization of those languages. And I know that's an area that you're interested in covering, and hopefully we see more stories like this in the future. So, Gunath Cheesh, for covering that story. Is there things that we can look forward to reporting-wise from you in the new year? I know you said there's going to be some work coming from Telephone Hill, and as tourism season approaches, I'm sure some of these other stories that you were following might creep back in. But is there other things we should be on the lookout for?
I think something that I'll be following closely again this year is the Juneau School District's budget. We're heading into a new legislative season, and Governor Mike Dunleavy's proposed budget doesn't include an increase to the per student funding that the state gives to public schools. So it'll be another challenging task for the school board to build its budget and, you know, kind of planning around some of that uncertainty. And I think, again, like last year, I expect there's going to be a big push for an increase in state funding. And I think seeing how that kind of trickles down to Juneau School District and Juneau's classrooms is something I'm really interested in following. So
That's great. Well, you can follow all of Katie's reporting at kto.org, Katie Anastas. And I want to ask you one final question. Will you share with us a book, a podcast, or hobby that you love? Or a thing, maybe, an animal?
I think you're talking about Bo, my cat.
I am. Yeah, you love cats.
I do. Yeah. I do love cats.
Yeah.
Bo is my little buddy. He just got back from the kitty hospital, so shout out to Summit Veterinary Services because they took very good care of him, and he's back to his old self.
That's KTOO reporter Katie Anastas. Gunath Cheesh for coming in today. You're listening to Juno Afternoon and KTOO's news coverage roundup for 2023. We'll be back after this break. Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com. You are listening to Juno Afternoon from Studio 2K at KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. This is our KTOO News Roundup Review for 2023. I'm joined now by KTOO reporter Yvonne Crumry, whose beat includes a wide variety of cultural events and human interest stories. Gunath Cheesh Ha'i Gudi. Thank you for being here today. What's up?
Play what's up? Not bad.
Awesome. So, Yvonne, you've been here, I think it's going to be 2 years in January?
Yes, that's right.
So will you remind us just a little bit about where you're from and your background before arriving here in Juneau?
I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri, and I've lived a few places since then. I was in Chicago before this, and I saw a former editor posted the job listing in the Women in Radio listserv. And I've always really wanted to know what Alaska's like. So I thought I would apply, and I'm still very grateful that I got this job.
That's great. And what originally drew you to journalism?
I had this realization when I was a little bit older. A lot of people who go into journalism have wanted to do it since they were like toddlers. I'm sure that's true for a couple other people in the newsroom. But I had this realization when I was a young adult, when I'd be listening to my friends talk about their lives and their stories. And I just had the sense that I thought more people should hear them and hear it in their voice and hear them speak it. And it was around the time that I started listening to public radio more myself. And it just dawned on me that that's something that I wanted to do and something I wanted to facilitate.
What is it about public media that, or public media journalism that sort of guides you?
Most journalism is amazing. And I especially really think that local news fills such a deep need in a community to stay connected to what's happening so that people can continue to weigh in on things that matter to them and know their community better. And public media, especially when the drive is to serve a community and to make sure that people know what they ought to know, as opposed to getting a bunch of clicks for advertisers or whatever else. That's what I like about KTOO and public media, is that our mission is about serving Juno above everything else.
Now, this year, you have covered everything from the burgeoning pinball scene in Juno to maybe Jimmy Manning baseball signs coming back over in Savico Park, all different kinds of stories. But I just want to call out a couple of the major stories that you did. One having to do with the volunteer who committed abuse over decades at Echo Ranch Bible Camp here in Juno, as well as sort of the reporting you've been doing and around the state that reporters have been doing on the continued high rates of suicide at Alaska prisons. And you can find those stories from Yvonne at kto.org. They're really important stories. And those are those human interest stories that are sometimes very serious, but so important. Important for us to hear about.
Yeah, thanks, Boston. I appreciate that.
But today, I just wanted to review two stories that you did that have sort of cultural impact. And one of them was the Hokulea canoe trip that happened. So let's take a listen to that story. And you were out there and getting some wonderful sound with this story. So let's take a listen to that.
Well, we're not going to drop. People on the shore heard the sounding of the conch as the twin-hulled, wind-powered voyaging canoe approached. Warmline-painted yachts brought the canoe to shore as dancers performed in cedar hats and Chilkat robes. Occoquan leaders welcomed the canoe to their homeland. Elder Fran Houston said the four-year journey will be special and good for the communities it touches.
It means a whole lot to everybody. The connection is powerful. Everything right now is powerful. And I'm just real happy and just tickled pink.
The crew of the Hokulea and their Southeast Navigators lined the beach, facing the Tlingit elders who came to greet them. Houston led a song she learned from her grandmother to the visitors.
It's with love. And I love singing it. And I'm surprised that I sang both verses twice. So, Gunakshish, I'd like to say you're welcome ashore. And I'm happy that you're here.
The crew, some dressed in t-shirts and hats, others in leis and malo, return the welcome with their own songs and chants. The Hokulea was returning from a voyage to Yakutat and other Southeast communities. On Thursday, the crew will begin a more than 40,000-mile journey called Moana Nuakea with the goal to learn about land stewardship and unity from Indigenous communities around the world. Nainoa Thompson, president of the Polynesian Voyaging Society, spoke to the crowd about that history and about the Voyaging Society's relationship with Southeast Alaska's Indigenous communities, who gifted the society two spruce trees in the 1990s to build another canoe.
I have the impossible task of kind of thanking everybody for not just making this day happen, but the whole journey through Southeast Alaska. That will take 2 months and about 1,200 miles.
Chris Blake is a part of the crew that traveled to Yakutat. Back home in Oahu, he teaches traditional non-instrumental navigation and wayfinding.
It was a 30-hour journey, being on the inland areas, and then when we got out to the ocean, it's definitely a lot colder than we were used to. But the amount of things that we're seeing and the unfamiliarity with it, we were a lot of elders and people who were much more familiar with the area were there to guide us.
Blake said he was energized by the navigation and voyaging skills shared by the Indigenous Hawaiians and Southeast Alaska Natives.
You know, it was such great to see the abilities that we have and how they parallel a lot of the experts who are familiar with these areas and how, you know, although we're not necessarily truly related, but how a lot of our similarities are able to help us and to drive us into the things that we have to do, got us to our destination.
Blake hopes he can be chosen to continue to participate in the Moana Nuakea voyage as it circles the Earth. In Juneau, I'm Yvonne Crumry.
That was such a major event here in Juneau. I remember there was, thousands of people watching it. Hundreds of people went out to watch this big ceremony that happened. And you go into that great detail in the story about the history of that and gathering wood from the trees here years ago, decades ago. And it's one of the reasons they wanted to start that journey here. And I just wanted to ask you, like, what's it like to cover an event like that?
I mean, it was really breathtaking to go down there. I was at Auk Rec and, you know, I spent a lot of time there, and just to suddenly see it so filled with people, so many Tlingit people, Tlingit elders, and to see this very traditional welcoming ceremony that's taken place for thousands of years between these two communities in different ways and, you know, and seeing Fran Houston welcome the Hokulea to shore, having all the like yachts out there, also meeting people at the bigger ship and bringing people in, with Tlingit people leading those yachts and doing the like call and response of like, who are you? What have you come to do? And answering that question like they've been doing for thousands of years in that traditional way. And that happens also at celebration, but to see it happen with this Hawaiian community that's been seafaring and doing their own journeys and welcoming and receiving ceremonies for years. It was really, really powerful, I think, for a lot of people there to see these two communities come together in the ways that they are aligned and sharing those traditions.
Yeah, it was amazing to watch the sort of the respect and the reverence and just the tradition. And it was heartwarming. It was really heartwarming to see that. And I loved that call and response when they were, you know, who are you? Why are you here? And it was so good. And just to be able to see that and to have great representation for the community there and to be able to cover that. I think we showed it on KTOO 360 TV and it was really wonderful. You could probably watch that video on demand on the Roku or Apple KTOO 360 TV app. Okay, so another story that I wanted to hear is the volunteers that are continuing to clean up the Douglas graveyard. So let's take a listen to that story.
Over the whine of weed whackers, about a dozen volunteers beat back bushes that cover old gravesites off of 3rd Street in Douglas. Stone markers lay at all angles. Stephanie Boma brought her two kids, Ori, who's 5, and Yachty, who's 2. Equipped with tiny rakes, they scoot leaves around the hillside. Boma says her family started volunteering at the cemeteries last summer because they want their kids to form a deeper relationship with the history and community around them.
And every time we drive by, they always talk about the cemetery now.
For 3 years, volunteers have been coming to the cemeteries to weed, clean gravestones, and clear brush. First, they worked on the Native Cemetery, a plot of land where Alaska Native people were buried for several decades, starting in 1901. Now they've started caring for the other cemeteries in the area, like the Asian Cemetery and the old Douglas City Cemetery that only served white people. Now passing drivers can see the old headstones peeking out between trees on either side of the road, where they weren't visible before. But the volunteers can only do so much to fight the rainforest's creep. Jamie Ann Sechten Hasselquist, who organizes the cleanups, says she wonders what the city could do to help.
All these volunteers coming together is just one more way to make things visible. And maybe that could add a little bit of pressure to the city and borough of Juneau to step up and start maintaining this area.
Mike Kinville says he loves the community that the cleanup days have created, but thinks there are parts of the work the city could take on.
For me, what would be perfect is some sort of partnership where the city provides some infrastructure and some supervision, like the branches we're cutting down.
The city and borough of Juneau has long said that it's not clear who owns the land the cemeteries are on. Nearly 30 years ago, it conducted an inventory of historic grave sites that outlines a convoluted history of ownership. It says a mining engineer who owned the area verbally agreed to give the land to the city of Douglas, but refused to put that in writing. Now, the city's parcel map says some of the land on the east side of the road is owned by Douglas and former Juneau mayor, Merrill Sanford. But Sanford says he only owns the Order of the Eagle Cemetery, which he maintains. It's fenced off from the rest of the graves. The parcel map also seems to show that the Catholic Church owns at least some of the land that the Native and Asian cemeteries are on. A representative of the Archdiocese of Anchorage and Juneau says that they're looking into that. Meanwhile, the cleanup job keeps getting bigger. Hasselquist says her team has uncovered dozens of other possible gravesites in the cemetery. They look like depressed rectangles in the land.
The report that was done like 28 years ago only had 5 of the Native people recorded and 3 of the Asian people recorded.
She says she since flagged more than 70 possible unmarked graves in those 2 sites. Kinville says they found 1 buried headstone by accident last fall when a volunteer's rake screeched against it.
There was a piece of marble, white marble, underneath the moss. And we dug it out and stood it up for the first time that headstone had been seen in I'm not sure how long.
Across the road, Hasselquist shows the work they've done to make the Douglas Cemetery navigable again. She says that until recently, you couldn't walk through it with all the salmonberry bushes. Now, just a low covering of deer heart leaves is underfoot, and a toy fawn lies on 1 child's grave.
There was a family that had been, they knew they had an ancestor buried there, but they didn't know where, so they bring flowers every year, and the kids come and help clean up, and, you know, there's a stuffed animal there.
Stories like these are why Kinville finds this work so valuable.
Come across these people, these connections, these stories, it's like a form of time travel for me. And it gives me a sense of connection to the community.
Back at their plot, Ori and Yadi take care with the century-old grave marker they're raking around. Their dad, Ephraim Froelich, says that he and Boma want their children to grow up feeling invested in the communities around them.
I think kids should be aware of what's happening around them, and we try to treat our kids like adults so they can be future responsible adults who aren't sheltered from important topics.
Topics like mortality, Froelich says, and the longstanding erasure of Indigenous culture. In Juneau, I'm Yvonne Crumry.
Okay, that sounds like a really important story, and I know the individual at the end there was talking about one of the things that they want to do, and part of this cleanup is also to make sure that kids are aware and that the the history is something that is so valued, and they want to make sure that it's represented, right? And so I'm just curious, like, is there going to be obviously this effort's going to be ongoing. Is there anything else that we know about this story, any follow-up to it?
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, it's been a couple different groups of volunteers over the years. This is the more recent one who've come in and kind of cleared away a lot of this really dense brush from salmon berries and things like that, and have like tried to restore gray markers and make it so you can actually walk through them again. Like when Jamie Ann was trying to do this a few years ago, she had to use a machete to get through. And a big part of that too is that it's become visible from the road on Douglas, which I think just creates a general sense of awareness that there even are these grave sites there. And a few volunteers are also doing a lot of genealogy work to try and connect people with these loved ones that might not know that they're buried there. And the bigger question in general is also just if this is possibly city land, or even if it's not, if it's possible that the city can help maintain it so that it doesn't get to that level again. Because as everyone knows here, nature moves in really quick in Southeast Alaska. So even if they're going out there every year, a few times a year, it's just that constant effort to maintain and keep the plants at bay. And so having a kind of baseline maintenance by city workers could allow them to continue doing the work of restoring the gravestones, finding out who these people were. They're still, most of the grave markers are still buried there. So there's a lot to be done. And it's really exciting, the work that people have been doing, like Bob Sam for 20 years in this area, and what could make it more permanent and sustained with the help of the city. And there's been talks about them stepping up to do that.
That's awesome. Well, thank you for that reporting, and thank you for all of the reporting you do. Like I said, you have such a wide variety of topics. I mean, human interest and cultural reporting can cover so many different areas, and it's a pleasure to read your stories. And so I want to thank you for coming in today. But I also wanted to ask you, is there anything that we can look forward to in the new year? Is there anything that you want to share about what we might be hearing from you on, or things that you might be doing that are interesting as you get to the new year?
Yeah, absolutely. KTO's new reporter, Clarice, and I will actually be visiting the warming shelter in Thane tonight to see what it looks like there. And we've heard from some of the people that work with the unhoused community in Juneau that it's going really well, and it's the best it's been in a long time. So that's really exciting. And I'm hoping to see how people who have experienced that and use those services feel about the differences. And as always, Southeast Alaska Native languages just continue to take these huge leaps and bounds in terms of making language learning more accessible to people. And there's a story coming soon about some new apps that are available to Small Yek and Hatkil learners. And that's really exciting.
That's cool. That's going to be so great. Okay. And final question. I'm asking everybody this, and I know that you love knitting. Because you knit a lot and it's a wonderful hobby. So I think that would be the hobby you would mention. So instead, I'm going to ask you, do you have a favorite book or podcast that you love?
I really like listening to fiction when I'm off. And so my favorite podcast these days and for a while now has been LeVar Burton Reads.
Oh, yes.
Reading Rainbow's LeVar Burton, and yeah. He reads stories for grownups too. And it's all speculative fiction. It's a lot of science fiction, a lot of just really beautiful stories by like a wide swath of authors that are putting things out these days.
Awesome. Well, Gunnath Cheesh, for coming in today, Yvonne. It's really been a pleasure. I hope you got all your knitting done for the holidays.
I'm still trying. Thank you.